My name is Roger Rowe. I've been a scholar of Claire's work for 40 plus years. In the past 10 or 12 years, worked very closely with the most famous scholar of Claire's work, probably in 200 years, Professor Eric Robinson, who took me under his wing. And I spent a great deal of time with him. And in fact, I'm his literary executor. Now, all that being said, I met him originally at a meeting of the John Clare Society. John Clare Society has been in existence for about 30 years. It was just a group of folk originally who thought, well, hang on a minute, we ought to do something about getting Clare's work in the hands of more folk, because he was pretty well ignored at the time. And they decided to meet together. And of course, like Topsy, it's grown. It's now one of the largest literary societies in the country. The society publish each year quite a number of different things, the main being the journal, which is an academic publication published every year. And there's newsletters and there's various gatherings and meetings from those in academia down to those like me who are very interested in Clare's work, from allowing him really to speak for himself, not being critical as the academics are of his work, critical in the right sense, of course, looking to find work that has not been published that opens a door to his thought. Now, Clare was massively ignored for many years. He published a few books in his own lifetime, four books. The first one sold like hotcakes, and everything else was ignored. And the vast majority of his writings were not published at all. And I spent the last 10 years, in fact, digging through the archives and gradually publishing lots and lots and lots of works of his that have never seen the light of day. Been very interesting, because you find stuff you don't expect, particularly about how common people, the ordinary folk, reacted to what was happening around them.
Now, I mean, when I first came across John Clare, it was, I mean, a much better known Thomas Hardy, because he wrote in some of his books about the changing face of rural England. I mean, he was writing about Wessex and Clare was writing about Northamptonshire. But I mean, it was similar thing. A lot of the old crafts dying out, a lot of land being enclosed or privatised. And so although obviously Hardy was writing later, can you just give us an idea of the enormous changes that were going on in the countryside that Clare wrote about?
Oh, indeed. I mean, I'll approach it from a very different point of view, you might think. All of us, I would have thought, more or less, have been blackberrying, gone out and picked blackberries. Now, it's the one thing that remains of the amazing amount of collection of eatables that common people used to gather in order to survive. Basically, when the common land was enclosed, all of a sudden they could not do what they had done, well, essentially for centuries. So everything you can possibly imagine was suddenly removed from them. Rabbits, hares, birds, reeds, cresses, sloes, mushrooms, elderberries, strawberries, blackberries, eggs, snakes, deers. Everything you can possibly imagine was suddenly closed off by the enclosure. And signs, which we have seen many times, saying trespassers will be prosecuted, suddenly started to appear. It's incredible to imagine that people used to scrape a living by tilling the land for the local landlord, but also managed to make ends meet by being able to go into the common lands and to collect all these other things that made their lives possible. remember, there's nothing, there's no no way that they could what's the right word to right way of putting it? There's no way that they could make ends meet except by going and collect it. Now, this even came down to the way that they kept their fires burning. Think about it. They couldn't afford to buy coal. So what did they do? Well, they collected wood. Clare calls them stickers. They went out into the woods, fields and commons collecting wood in order that they could build a fire to keep warm and to cook. Now, that was suddenly illegal. They couldn't do that because the local landowner kept them off the land by the new fences that had been put up. It's an incredible thing when you think about it. Clare said this. I really rather like this four lines of his. Where stickers stroll from day to day and gather loads of rotten wood, and poachers left in safety stray when midnight wears its deepest mood. What he's talking about was, not only were poachers, of course, they wouldn't have been poachers previously because they would have been working on the commons, collecting some food for the pot, but all of a sudden they were, prosecuted, transported in some cases for doing what people had done for hundreds of years. Silently moving lines of figures in the woods and commons, Clare describes them. And he talks about the new landowners making a prison of the forests, and in fact are the jailers of the forests. Right across Europe, in fact, where there was enclosures, this happened. Even simple things like blackberries and sticks for your fire were suddenly illegal to collect. It's incredible.
It is amazing, and it was an enormous transformation. Nowadays we think of commons as places where, maybe you might be driving. I'm thinking particularly about Minchin Hampton in Gloucestershire, where you drive across there and suddenly a cow will wander out in front of you, you know, or especially in the evening, they can sort of loom up in front of the car. You've got to slow down and just wait for them trot off, because they normally don't loiter on the road because there's no grass to chew there. That sort of place. And the commons we think of as a place where people do have a right to wander, to park, to maybe have a picnic and then move on. But actually, there's a lot more to it than that, isn't there? The common, it's not common ownership, it's common rights. So you may have a lord of the manor that owns that land, but the ordinary people have a right to do things like, it wasn't just having a right to roam or sit down and have a picnic. It was access to the resources of the land, including in villages, what were called the open fields, which, I mean, I remember years ago visiting a place called Laxton in Nottinghamshire, which apparently is the only village in the UK, or in England anyway, still, that has uses the old medieval open field system that was never enclosed. And it's I believe, part of the Crown estate. But in Laxton, for example, there are fields in the old three-field system where they rotate the crops, and one of those fields is fallow every year to stop, you know, to give the land a bit of a chance to gather some nutrients, so it's not having to produce vegetables every year, year after year after year. But the point being that these were essentially gigantic allotments, which were used by the villagers to keep themselves alive.
Well, partially, that's true. And also, of course, a villager could graze a cow on the commons, could keep a few sheep, perhaps, or a pig. But it's not just cultivated land, as you suggested, with strips. I'm fortunate to live in East Devon, and we have still a very large common. It's never been cultivated. It is huge. Most people don't know about it. It would be called, I suppose, Lowland Heath to most folk. It has all the aspects of the Moors, as Claire would have called them, in the 21st century. You can walk over it. You can do all kinds of things to it. There are a few roads, but very few. You can. It's incredible place. Now, if that was suddenly enclosed, thinking back 200 years, and the man who let his cow wander, as they do still on Dartmoor, incidentally, if that was suddenly taken away, where would he take the cow for fodder? And the answer was he couldn't take it anywhere. Therefore, that one means of supporting himself would be taken away. And of course, at the same time as all this was happening, the ordinary people who couldn't cope, who were being driven basically into the ground, started to leave the land. They had no choice in a way, because there was nothing there for them anymore. And they moved to the cities, where at least they might get something to eat. Or, and it's a big thing, this is the period when the union workhouse started. There were workhouses previously, of course, but very small in each parish. All of a sudden, the union workhouse started. And so people at the bottom of the pile just were essentially thrown into the workhouse, where they would work until they died. Pretty boring work too, a lot of them did. So you can understand folk like Claire looking at the situation all the way around him, describing as he does the terrible state of the folk that he's living with, because he still lived in Helpston in Northamptonshire at that time, until, of course, he ended in an asylum. But his whole thrust of what he was writing, and not published, of course, at that time, has to do with this terrible, terrible stealing of the land by the people who were in authority.
Well hang on, Roger. How can you call it stealing? These enclosures were carried out by Acts of Parliament, individually.
Well, of course they were. Well, of course they were carried out by, and who were in Parliament? The landowners. So they were essentially passing a series of acts, giving themselves the benefit. It's incredible, but that's true. That's absolutely true. A little while ago, I produced a book called Accursed Wealth. And I sent a copy to a certain Mr. Corbyn. And he read a piece about the enclosures at, where was it again? It was at one of the big meetings, explaining that things had not changed in 200 years. The Parliament was passing acts, giving themselves the Commons.
I mean, that's the MPs, but surely, you know, ordinary people could vote for those MPs or not.
No, ordinary people couldn't vote at all. They didn't have the vote. They didn't have the vote at this time at all, not for very many years. I always remember the phrase from Das Kapital of Karl Marx. He said, this was a systematic seizure of communal landed property. Yeah, systematic seizure. Most people have not read it, of course, but he was right. He was right. The parliamentary form of the robbery was to pass acts for the enclosure of the Commons.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, you're saying robbery, that's theft with violence. And many of these people were actually violently evicted from their homes at the same time as the land was enclosed. Yes.
Precisely the same thing, of course, happened in the clearances in Scotland. By different people for different reasons. Well, no, the same reason, actually. They wanted to clear the land. So one way or another, poor John Clare, trying to describe all this that was happening, he did actually try to publish something on this. And he published it in the second book, published in 1821. which didn't sell very well. It doesn't surprise me at all, because who bought the books? People who could read, people who were of the middle and upper classes, and they were the people who were voting themselves the commons, the enclosures writ large. I mean, it's privatization. You use the word. It's privatization writ large. Still happening exactly the same 200 years ago. I find it sad. I think that's the right word.
Well, yes. I
Very
mean,
sad.
It's a shared resource, which is being basically hoarded by a few. But look, after people have been evicted from cottages, you know, quite often, I remember reading, this is years ago now, but that quite often the stone from the cottages was used to build a nice new manor house for the for the Lord of the Manor. In fact, many of our country piles, you know, around Britain, they sprung up around about the same time as these enclosures. John Clare was living from the 1790s to the
1790 to 1864.
Yes, yeah, so to the 1860s, and so he was right smack bang in the middle of all of this. But
he was.
But once the people had been cleared out of the way, you know, and that's of course what the you're right, you know, talking about the clearances. That's exactly what they were doing. What went in their place?
Well, the people were working farms, large farms, capital farms, they were called. With fewer people to work them, machinery started to come in, thus getting rid of another group of highly skilled people. The farms became much more profitable. Let's not forget that. That's true. But the people never benefited one little piece. The farms had nice new roads. They had nice new straight lines to plow, lots of new hedges. Most of the hedges that we think are ancient were put together at the enclosures. That's what it's called, enclosed land. So the farmers did very well indeed out of it, very well indeed. And many of them went up in the world, as they say, from a social point of view, and started to have, well, some of the upper classes used to want, would then start talking, well, so-and-so's in trade, you know, or in a farm. Which amuses me quite a lot too. There were fewer people on the land, but they didn't want any more people on the land. They wanted fewer people because it didn't. They didn't need a lot of folk to run these new capital farms. They needed
I'm starting to think now about people like the Luddites who resented these new machinery, this new machinery turning up. And I know James Watt began the revolution with the steam engine, 1776, that was just 20 years before Clare was born. Yes. And so I suppose that also drove this, because as these dark satanic mills started to spring up with the steam engine powering them, I mean, many of them, of course, were water powered too, that must have actually, you know, given an incentive both for the landowners to do the enclosing and also for these new mill owners to bring these newly evicted people in to work for them.
Yep, absolutely. Clare only mentions that sort of aspect of the Industrial Revolution only in one poem. It's quite interesting. It's a sonnet where the second to last line, he's talking about the fall, a sort of a picture of Eden falling to a hell in this particular poem. And he talks about all this incense in the past and the blessing, the husbandman and harvests and all these wonderful things. And the second and last line says, till smoking chimneys sicken the young light and feeling's fairy visions fade away. A quite powerful 14 lines, actually. Again, not well known at all. That's often the case with Clare, not published at the time. And he's seeing this as a fall, literally, from an Eden that existed before the enclosures to what enclosures brought forth.
I mean, isn't he romanticising that a bit? I mean, this is
might
call progress, isn't it? I mean, it's something's changing in society.
Yes, he's saying it to make a point. in that kind of way. And I wrote a book about this, or a collection of Clare's poems about this very subject, the fall that he saw, he observed. He talks about the people being banished now from the heaths. And that's quite a powerful thing to say. Banished from the heaths. Well, of course they were. Do not cross this line. Trespassers will be prosecuted.
Well, that's right. This is a sign we're very familiar with today. But can you maybe pick out a couple of his poems that you think have really, maybe made an impact? Because, like you say, in his own time, he wasn't really recognised much as a poet. But more recently, there's been an enormous,
absolutely massive,
big posthumous pat on the back in the 20th and the 21st century.
Oh yes.
So can you pick out a couple of his poems that you think enjoy?
Yeah. He's now regarded, incidentally, as probably the most important poet of the Romantic period, because he speaks to everyone. Okay, two quotes. This is from a poem that was written in the 1820s, four lines. Enclosure came and trampled on the grave of labor's rights and left the poor a slave, and birds and trees and flowers without a name all sighed when lawless laws enclosure came. Very important four lines. And here's eight lines from a poem that was published in his first book, and lots of folk in authority, as it were, asked that they be removed. And after the third edition of that book, because it went to six editions very fast, they were removed. And you listen to these lines. Accursed wealth.
Sorry to stop you in mid-flow, but can you just give us the names of these poems just before you start them?
Oh, of course, yes. This Accursed Wealth is from the books, The Poems Descriptive of Rural Life and Scenery, published in 1820, and the poem is called Helpston. It's a very, very long poem. Accursed wealth, or bounding human laws, of every evil there remain the cause. Victims of want, those wretches such as me, too truly lay their wretchedness to thee. Thou art the bar that keeps from being fed, and thine are loss of labour and of bread. Thou art the cause that levels every tree, and woods bow down to clear a way for thee. Powerful words. They were expunged from later editions, from Lord this and Earl that and Lady this, who objected to them. I've republished those myself in various books because I think they're so important that people understand.
Well, isn't that interesting that censorship should be used against someone who actually at the time was, fairly obscure poet?
Absolutely. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, I just love that. That people should think him so important that they should censor him. But the first book that comes from, first couple of editions at least, did sell like hotcakes. He outsold everybody, all the poets of the time, your Byrons and so on. They were all outsold by Clare in that book. It was amazing.
It is incredible.
I think it came as a great surprise as well.
Probably to him as well. Anyway, so what about his time in the mental asylum? Because, of course, that makes it very easy for people to point the finger at him now and say, well, actually, it's all very well. It's some quite nice words here, but the guy was a lunatic.
Yeah, well, that's hilarious as well, because, of course, he wasn't. Do you know what he was committed for? I've got a copy of the original paper. He was committed for writing poetry. True. Poetic prosing, they called it, and they locked him up. Now, he was ill. There is no doubt about that. But mad? No chance. Not at all.
Did he manage to carry on writing in the asylum?
Oh, yes. He never stopped. It was very fortunate, actually, that he spent altogether 28 years in two different asylums. The Northampton Asylum, where he was for 25 of those years, they were very sympathetic to him. And he was treated extremely well. And he was given paper, which was very expensive at the time, and on which to write. And he wrote vast amounts, much of which, well, obviously none of it was published in his time. The original manuscripts don't come down to us from that time, but one of the superintendents of the asylum copied down hundreds of poems, and those have come down to us. And they're very much Clare. I mean, you can tell anyone who studies Clare can spot his poetry very easily indeed. And so probably his most famous poem, which is called I Am, was written in the asylum in the 1850s. And that poem has been in, well, hundreds, I would have thought, of collections. And a lot of people think, well, that's all that Clare wrote. But of course, not true. He was disturbed of mind. There is no doubt about that. But he was ill. In modern terms, he would never have been in any kind of secure accommodation at all. And in fact, things were so enlightened in lots of ways in that asylum in Northampton that he was allowed out on a daily basis, and he'd go wandering to the town, and he'd go and sit in the portico of one of the churches, and people used to know who he was. They would go and chat to him, ask him if he could write them a poem, which he often did. So it was mad? No. Disturbed? Yes. I can read you I Am if you want, but many people will have heard it, of course.
Well, I think maybe an extract, so long as it's not too long.
It's three verses of six lines.
Oh, well, go for it.
Okay. This is Clare's most famous poem for very obvious reasons. I am, yet what I am none cares or knows. My friends forsake me like a memory lost. I am the self-consumer of my woes. They rise and vanish in oblivious host, like shades in love and death's oblivion lost. And yet I am, and live with shadows tossed into the nothingness of scorn and noise, into the living sea of waking dreams, where there is neither sense of life nor joys, but the vast shipwreck of my life's esteems. And in the dearest that I love the best are strange, nay, rather stranger than the rest. I long for scenes where man has never trod, a place where woman never smiled or wept, and there to abide with my creator God and sleep as I in childhood sweetly slept, untroubling and untroubled where I lie, the grass below, above the vaulted sky. That's Clare. A poem which so many people, including lots of very famous poets indeed, think is one of the best things that ever came out of the Romantic movement.
Yeah, quite incredible, really. And I think what you get the sense that he really felt the people being ripped away from their home, their land, you know, the everything that they held dear and that which they needed to survive, to live from day to day. Anyway, Roger, what about if someone is, you know, interested in Clare, never mind, there's plenty of poetry collections out there, but could you just recommend something that you've done that people might find interesting as part of your research and the public?
Yeah, there's now 24 books. Ridiculous.
Well, if you can pick out one that people might find particularly interesting.
Oh, yes. The one which is also about the enclosures is called Eden Defiled. Eden Defiled. I put it out about 18 months ago. This is not a large book. It has 32 pages. It's a collection of Clare's work reflecting his, I suppose you could say, philosophical understanding of the enclosures and what that meant to humankind, or men and women that he knew. So it starts in Eden and it ends defiled. That book is, most people buy books directly from me. It's very inexpensive. It's £3.50. Most of my books are created in order to spread the word about Clare, and I sell them at a very low price for that reason. That doesn't mean there aren't some more expensive ones. There are.
Well, there is one book that sprung out at me when I was at John Clare's birthplace recently.
Yeah.
And that was called John Clare the Trespasser, which I rather like the sound of that.
Oh, yes.
I mean, yeah. Obviously, he is somebody that really felt the idea, this coming in, where paths that he walked as a child suddenly were barred to him.
That's a very good book.
And also, I think he wrote a poem, didn't he, saying trespass?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, there's a whole load of poems that talk about trespass. The one you're thinking of, I think, is where he's accused by a gamekeeper of trespassing and stealing things from the land, which he never, ever did. And it's quite a famous famous couple of words where he says he complains that the gamekeeper is making accusations at him when they're not true at all. But there are quite a few poems that talk in that kind of way, you know, everything from, well, there used to be a gate there, but it's not there now. Why? There used to be a spring here, but that spring is now being canalized, made into a canal. Yeah. Why? That's kind of thing. There's lots and lots of, I suppose you could say he is complaining to no one, because no one read this stuff until much, much later. He's recording
he's complaining
what
to
he thinks.
Anyway now. I mean, yeah. I think it's great, you know, because particularly some of our youngsters can learn a little bit about history from him. But anyway, look, finally, can you just quickly tell us whereabouts the John Clare Society can be found and where people are interested?
Oh, yes. Best thing to do, John Clare Society, is go onto Facebook and type in John Clare Society, and you will hit their homepage, which I designed. There's also a second Facebook group, which is called John Clare Poet, which is my personal one, which has been going for a very long time. And we've got vast numbers of readers and people who can contribute, of course. Many people contribute. So there are two: John Clare Society, Facebook, John Clare Poet, Facebook.
Yeah, and I would also recommend
vast amounts there.
Well, yeah, I'd also recommend anybody to go and visit Helpston, which is just near Peterborough,
yeah,
which is John Clare's original home. There's a terrific little tea shop and a cafe as well, which I partook in.
Finally, I have a website which is called John Clare, and the address is johnclare.blogspot.com. It is vast and totally searchable.
All right, Roger Rowe from the John Clare Society, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.